bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
I have a theory, and the theory is this.
I would sincerely like to apologize.
He has a tractor and he smashes up old cars.
I knew just it would be successful because there are all kinds of people that want to get
by Alaska in the
evil
1950s.
Evil white man.
World famous Phil Hendry Show here every night until 1 o'clock on the West Coast and 4 a.m. on the East Coast. The only news talk and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about. Our number 877-876-PHIL, 877-876-PHIL. And you can also go to Twitter, twitter.com/realphilhendry, and weigh in with us over there. You can go to Facebook, facebook.com/philhendry. Excuse me. I just had...
What are you getting? Something in your throat.
No kidding, man. Yeah, I got something in my throat. Yeah.
All right. Just checking. I want to make sure.
Will you call up Mr. Hall and tell him Phil's got something in his throat? And don't get smart about it either.
Yeah, man. Tell me.
Man testifies he expected God to heal his child. You know, we talked about this last hour, I have what's called a compelling interest in these kinds of topics, you know, because religion's a really important question. Now, and here was the courtroom listening to this guy's claptrap about healing his child and God and how the kid's, you know, frankly, secondary, the kid's well-being is secondary, whatever the hell it is he thinks God's telling him. This is insanity is what this is. This is insanity. Now I got a story here. A federal appeals court on Friday ruled in favor of allowing a Santeria priest to sacrifice goats in his Texas home, saying a city's decision to prohibit the ritual violated the man's religious rights. Now, I kind of like that. I think that's fantastic. You know why? Because I can't wait to see PETA now walking across the street from this cat's house with their signs about goat love. That's going to be one for the books. Oh, yeah.
We got to send a camera down there.
You better believe it. Let's go, PETA. Come on, man. The guy is sacrificing goats. Let's go. I don't know which side of the fence I'm on this one. I don't know which side of the barnyard fence I'm on. But it's worth it to me just to see you guys jumping up and down and getting crazy about some guy sacrificing goats in his house. In his house. Now, why did they rule in favor of this guy sacrificing goats? Because I'll tell you, they've had rulings in the past that prohibited them from sacrificing animals. I think they ruled that it was cruel. It was inhumane to the animal. But we do know that we kill goats and we kill, you know, cows, and we kill a lot of animals for a variety of reasons. Most of the reasoning has to do with eating them. We have some that are good for warmth. Some people don't like us killing animals for the warmth of the fur because they feel that that's an unnecessary killing of that animal, and therefore it's a cruel killing of that animal, and therefore if you wear fur, you're just a murdering fraulein. You're one of Hitler's, you know, sex concubines. I personally admire you. What man doesn't admire a woman in a fur coat? What woman doesn't like wearing a fur coat? What woman doesn't like wearing a fur coat with nothing on underneath? You know, it just goes on and on and on and on. And while some people may say, yeah, Phil, but you may see a woman in a fur coat. Do you ever stop to ask if it's real? Yes.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
You know, even if it was fake?
If it's fake, it's, I don't know, it looks like crap. You know, if she said, if a woman, you know, says, I have a fur coat, but it's fake. I said, what the hell are you talking about? It's fake. What are you doing with me if you're wearing a fake coat? Only women wearing real animal fur belong with me. You know, you just make those stupid comments. Because I don't really know. I don't know. I my own feeling is this. I'll wear animal fur if there's nothing else. Other than that, you know. And, of course, you don't wear the fur if the animal's in danger. There's a lot of other reasons why you wouldn't wear animal fur. And there's a lot of reasons why we don't kill animals beyond the aspect of cruelty. Some of them are endangered, and some, in the case of the bald eagle, of course, that's our national symbol. Nobody kills a bald eagle. That's the symbol of America. And as I've come to find out in recent days, the bald eagle is plentiful in Canada. There's lots of bald eagles in Canada. In fact, bald eagles nest right near urban centers in Canada. See, they're our national bird, but do they want to have anything to do with us? No, they're hanging out in Canada. Thank you. Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, but bet you we got a lot of maple, like maple.
Maple what?
You talking about a maple tree, man? Well, I don't know what it is, but do we have maple?
What do you mean, do we have maple?
He's talking about a maple tree. You mean a maple tree?
I don't know. What do you mean?
Well, what do you mean, a maple?
Maple. The cereal.
The cereal?
What are you talking about, man? You mean Maypo?
You're talking about Maypo.
Oh, yeah, but that's a symbol of Canada.
Maypo the cereal is the symbol of Canada. No, it isn't, man. The maple leaf is the symbol of Canada.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
No, that's not what you meant. No, it isn't what you meant.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't, man, because I listened very carefully to everything you just said, and you were saying, Maypo, do we have Maypo? Maypo?
Yeah, man, you were talking about Maypo the cereal, and not a maple. I said a maple tree.
Ah, shut up.
Tell me to shut up.
Wait a minute. The maple leaf is the symbol of Canada. Are you saying we got a lot of maple trees?
Yeah.
I don't know if we have a lot of maple trees. I guess we do. Do we have more maple trees than they do? Why am I even talking about this, man?
Did you brought up how they got a lot of balded eagles?
Balded eagles. Yeah, that's right. They do. In any event, you say you can't kill the eagle, right? So there's a lot of good reasons, a lot of bad reasons, but nonetheless, there are rules and regulations regarding the killing of animals. Now, a guy that wants to sacrifice a goat, so long as he's not torturing the damn thing, what do I care? You know? See, the way I got it figured, Santeria, and I've known for years that Santeria and Santeros, these are the priests, the people that practice as well, I think are called Santeros or Santo or Jay Santos or something like that.
You gotta call him up.
Yeah, I'll get Jay Santos on the phone and find out if they named a religion after him. And nonetheless, these cats sacrifice animals, okay? So when they sacrifice the animal, they are exercising their religious freedom. Now, an animal ain't a human being, last time I checked. That's number one. They're not covered under the Bill of Rights, number two. They are protected against any cruel action. That's very, very, that's a good law. We don't want to be cruel to animals. We don't want to torture animals. They're sentient beings. They feel pain. They are wounded and they are traumatized by that kind of action. But to slaughter an animal for any other reason, I think is fine. Meaning, if you want to eat it, if you want to wear it, if you want to sacrifice it to your, you know, chicken god or whatever it is you're doing, no problem. None at all. The only problem I've got is that the guy is slaughtering goats in his house, and I know that stink is going to drift over the fence into my yard. And that's where I draw the line. That's where I draw the line. You can kill anything you want, man. You can slaughter anything you want if you do it the right way. But when I got to smell it, what is this?
I think it's appropriate.
Oh, I see. So I'm a big crybaby?
Yeah, you're crying about a stink of a goat, man. When the last time you smelled goat?
The last time I smelled goat, you want to know where?
Where?
Miami. Miami. What are you guys looking at?
Yeah, so what?
Miami is where these guys live, man. It's where these chicken and these goat sacrificers live. All through Miami. And what was with that music? So I'm a big crybaby, is that right?
Yeah, you're all crying and everything.
I'm not turn it off. I didn't cry about anything, man. I don't care if they kill a damn goat. Let them kill all the goats they want, man. As far as I'm concerned, I've had goats, too. It sucks. There's only two reasons that we have goats. One, they eat garbage. And if you've been down to the Caribbean and you've been on islands like Jamaica, rather than actually have a sanitation service in Jamaica, they just let loose the goats. Everywhere you go in Jamaica, there's a goat. You want to know why? It eats garbage. Last time I saw a goat, actually, was here in California. They had goats on a hillside overlooking Malibu. Why? There was a lot of high grass that the guy didn't want to pay to cut down, so he just unleashed a bunch of goats. And as I'm driving up the road, I'm looking at this herd of goats like I'm in a Ricola commercial or something, like I'm waiting for the Swiss Miss to come dancing down the hill with a milk bucket, and these goats are eating all of this grass, and I'm driving by and I'm going, say now, that's nutty. Darn good thing I don't use drugs. Much. No, I don't. Now, so goats, go ahead, and goat stew, the worst thing you ever had in your life, man.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I had that down in Miami, too. I went to this Haitian place, and I saw goat stew. I ate it, and I said, okay, so I've done that, and I've also almost had my eyes put out. And let's see, I also stuck my hand in a bonfire, so okay, I've got goat out of the way now. So anyway, this appellate court has ruled that this gentleman, his name is Jose Merced, He actually lives in Texas. He's in Dallas, Texas. He is allowed to sacrifice goats. You can't torture the animal, but if you want to kill the damn thing, like the rabbi when he kills the, you know, the steer or whatever to make it kosher, that's the way it goes. You can't kill kids. Goats, okay. This has been the Phil Hendry Religion Hour here. Every night we... Anyway, 877-876-PHIL, and at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking to Professor Gorn on the John Dillinger book, Dillinger's Wild Ride, the book he wrote about John Dillinger's 1933-1934 bank robbery spree that ended with his death by gunfire in Chicago. That's coming up on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Phil Hendry 877-876-PHIL, and a couple of stories that you might be interested in here having to do with gay, you know, straight guys being called gay. Apparently, Governor Rick Perry is accusing an opponent in Texas of slandering him because he says they've got a hidden phrase on their website that says Rick Perry is gay. Now, this is the same governor that wanted to secede from the union. I know he wasn't serious. Yeah, okay, sure. He wasn't serious, man, like I'll bet you he was. And when people finally clued him in, you know, you sound like an idiot. Then he, well, you know, I wasn't serious, really. Yes, you sounded stupid when you said that, man. Now his cat says that a website for U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson contains hidden phrases, including Rick Perry gay. Now, you got to laugh at that. I don't know. It's funny. But anyway, Governor Rick Perry's campaign is accusing the Hutchinson team of being slanderous and of setting a negative and divisive tone. The two Republicans are running for governor in next year's GOP primary. The Austin American-Statesman reported on Thursday on the phrases. Hutchinson spokesman Jeff Sadowski said Hutchinson's campaign was not condoning those words and did not know thousands of people would be searching for them. He said they would be removed from the site. So in other words, because this story isn't clear, the website of Kay Bailey Hutchinson uses Google search so that when you enter in Rick Perry's name, the phrase Rick Perry gay will come up. Many of you who have used the search engines, a variety of search engines, know that certain phrases will come up. Are you looking for this? Because this is a very much searched issue. And apparently people, after looking at Rick Perry, maybe after the tea parties, I don't know, maybe it's because he's kind of a handsome guy. Maybe that automatically qualifies you as being gay. You know, which is one of the reasons why everyone is just rock solid on my orientation, straight, you know.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, so Perry, for whatever reason, Perry's name is searched in conjunction with the word gay. Now, when you use the search feature on the Kay Bailey Hutchinson website, just as if you were to use the search feature on a news site that I have called TheRealPhilHendry.com. It's a news site, and we have a search engine there, and I think it's Google. So when you enter in certain phrases, those of you who may not be familiar, I know probably most of you are, you're going to get a variety of options. Do you want Rick Perry gay? No, I don't. Do you want Rick Perry Texas? Rick Perry, you know, he's got horns, and only two people got horns. That's a steer and a queer, you know. Is it Rick Perry? You know, there's that whole, well, never mind. I don't want to get into that joke about the, yeah. So what's the problem? Well, they're saying because they're not particularly familiar, maybe they're not particularly familiar with how these search engines work, or maybe they are and they're using it to, you know, dump some crap on Hutchinson. But either way, folks, this is another marvelous example of how stupidity combined with the opportunities that stupidity present to us makes for a wonderful sidebar in this Hutchinson and Perry, you know, campaign, but it don't tell us nothing about either one of these people other than the fact that the Perry people are a little dim when it comes to search engines, and Hutchinson's people ain't too bright either. Because maybe they would have taken the search feature off of their website or perhaps used another search feature or constructed their own. I don't know. Personally, if I was advising Kay Bailey Hutchins, I'd say, don't worry about it, okay? Keep the feature up and let Rick Perry, let him wallow in his own paranoia about being gay. Is he married, by the way?
Oh, let me check.
Okay, because if he's not, he's queer. I'm joking around, Governor. You know me, don't you? You don't? I'm Phil Hendry. And I'm going to come to your next tea party, man, and I'm going to be there with you, and I can't really say that I'm going to enjoy myself, but I'll stand next to you, and anybody that wants to throw some crap on you, man, you just let me know, because I'll be with you for a while, and then I'm going on over to the, I'm sure you understand, the Cajun booth, where they have some dancing and concertinas. Now, the other gay story has to do with a coach of the University of Hawaii, I believe, football team, and this man, Greg McMacklin, had to apologize on Thursday because he used a pretty hard word, man, kind of a hardcore word to be using, even if you are talking to the press. I have to tell you, though, this is something that bothers me. Now, this guy is a football coach, and he's used to talking frankly and maybe not so politically correctly with other football players and writers and this and that. It's a very good reason for people to say the guy should not have said it, because if you're sitting around reporters, come on, man, you know. However, who are these reporters that just run off to their newsroom and say, he said the word F, you know? The word that he used, the audio is slightly difficult to make out in full. The coach says the phrase, little, and I'm quoting here, little faggot dance, end quote. So let's listen here. This is University of Hawaii football coach Greg McMacklin. And he is in some kind of, I believe he must be in some sort of a press venue. He's using a gay slur to refer to a Notre Dame chant. And I don't know what that chant is, but he describes it as a little faggot dance. Let's listen to this. We'll try to roll off some of these low ends because it's kind of tough to hear.
He had his guys, we do something special at Notre Dame, he said. And they get out and they do this little cheer. Like this, you know, little faggot.
You know? There it is.
And you remember Jason and Steven? So the guys are looking at me. You know, they're all looking and all trying not to laugh. And so I gave them the, don't write that faggot down. I was misquoted.
So you hear him, he said, don't write that, quote, little faggot dance comment. I was misquoted. He believes he's speaking to a group of people who've got his back. I guess maybe he thinks he's Newt Rockne. I guess he thinks this is back in the day when, you know, sports reporters did have the back of these guys and wouldn't, you know, say diddly. So they didn't. They ran back to their newsrooms. They reported it. And so the cat's got to apologize. Here he is, I believe, the next day or the day after or something, just before he slit his wrists. No, he didn't. But, boy, if he had that, whoever that reporter was, he'd be probably feeling pretty bad.
I would sincerely like to apologize for the inappropriate verbiage or words that I used. What I was trying to do is be funny, and it wasn't funny, and it's not funny, and even more, it isn't funny to me. And I was trying to, you know, make a joke, and it was a bad choice of words, and I really feel bad about it.
All right, University of Hawaii student defends the coach's choice of words.
If you say something like that, you don't necessarily mean, like, I hate gay people, or, you know, I have these views about this certain group of people. I think maybe it was meant as kind of a diss on the dance.
It is a diss. The word, you know, quote, faggot, end quote, is a word that, you know, has been used for many, many years. Decades, if not hundreds of years, to connote homosexuals, and it's derogatory. Now that we know this, And many gay people have said that it's as explosive and as damaging as the N-word, you know. And we know what happens to people who use the N-word. The only problem I got with all of this is I believe the coach when he says he's sorry, he didn't mean to diss. He's not a bright man. I don't think anybody talking in front of reporters should use that word, because you got to know what's going to happen, man. You know they're going to go back and they're going to report it. The only thing the guy is guilty of is being stupid. I don't believe, if he says he's not a bigot, I'll take him at his word, because I've heard that word used plenty of times by all kinds of people, many of them
the most progressive.
We'll be back with John Dillon.
Phil Hendry. Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
World famous Phil Hendry Show, and back again with another Crime Night interview tonight. We have Professor Elliot J. Gorn, and Professor Gorn is a professor of history and American studies at Brown University, and he is the author of a new book called Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One. And with the release of Public Enemies, the film, people are interested yet again in the life and times of John Dillinger, whose very name sounds like a bit of ordinance. And Professor Gorn, and I will call you Elliot, welcome to our program. Thanks for joining us. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Phil.
And the timing of your book and the release of the Johnny Depp film seems fortuitous. Have you gotten, I suppose you're getting a lot of interest in John Dillinger because of the movie. But John Dillinger has never really been an uninteresting person. He's always been the subject of people's fascination and avocations, hasn't he, for a long time?
Oh, absolutely. This is a story that just keeps coming back and coming back. We just passed the 75th anniversary of his death on July 22nd. Mm-hmm. And this is something year after year, every generation seems to rediscover John Dillinger. A new big film comes out, more books come out, and people rethink the whole Dillinger story.
And we're looking at a period in American history when crime, there was a whole new breed of criminal, and therefore law enforcement had to deal with them in a whole new way. We had a new Federal Bureau of Investigation, and there were all kinds of guys that have been the stuff of legend. Some of them worked with John Dillinger, such as Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd. Tell me about John Dillinger, though. Where was he from originally? Tell me about his childhood and where everything started to go wrong in his life, if you wouldn't mind, Elliot.
Oh, I'm happy to. And I should say that, you know, different people who've looked into the life of Dillinger would probably give you a little different story on this. Mm-hmm. Everyone would agree that he was born and raised in the city of Indianapolis, although he's always sort of depicted as a country boy, and that's because the mm-hmm. family moved to Mooresville, Indiana, 25 miles west of Indianapolis, when he was in his teens. But he actually grew up in the city. His dad was a grocer. Mm-hmm. He grew up in a working-class neighborhood. Seemed like a fairly stable family, though one of the things that some people say is really significant in his life was the death of his mother at an early age. She passed away when he was three. Now, honest, in doing my research, I am not convinced that Dillinger was such a wild kid as others have made him out to be. I found very little evidence of this. People have talked about this and asserted it. But, you know, when you look at the record and you look for evidence of him being, you know, one of those out-of-control kids, you really don't find it. He was a fairly stable kid, a little high-strung, maybe got into a little bit of trouble, but nothing unusual. Mm-hmm. In his teens, he did join the Navy, got into a little bit of trouble, joined the Navy, and went AWOL. That's the first indication of something going on. And yet, you get to him being age 21, and it's not as if you see a lot of problems. He was a good ball player, played on a local semi-pro team in Martinsville, Indiana. Anyway, age 21, he commits a stick-up. He and an accomplice, an ex-con, commit a stick-up, a violent felony. Dillinger is sentenced to given a 20-year sentence for this. He pleads innocent, throws himself on the mercy of the court, as his father tells him to do. He's given a 20-year sentence, of which he serves nine. He's almost 30 years old when he comes out of prison. His accomplice, who was the more experienced felon, hires a lawyer, does it right, so to speak, and he's out in 2 years. this is something that always made Dillinger very bitter. And I think he really does learn who he's going to be, learns the ways of
us. Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds to me from your read that he was criminalized essentially by the prison system. Although that stick-up is something that indicates a guy who's simply, you know, not comfortable with the rules the way that they're written. But to go from doing a stick-up to one of the most notorious criminals in America, he must have had an experience in prison, don't you think, that that really turned him hardcore?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, he was very – there are some letters that survive and so on, and prison was really tough for him. He really hated it. Mm. He resisted it, and he met guys who – the men who became the core of the Dillinger Gang, who knew how to do bank robberies, knew where the fences yeah. were, knew how to think about – you know, state and city borders, jurisdictional borders, how to get away with a good bank robbery, so to speak.
Hey, Elliot, I wanted to ask you, we may be jumping around here a little bit, but when does he make the acquaintance of the famous Babyface Nelson? How well did they work together? I know that it didn't end up too good. I was going to ask you, who were the more notorious individuals that he did team up with in his crime spree?
Nelson is certainly the most important one. It's actually unclear if he really did team up at any point with Pretty Boy Floyd. There were rumors of it, but there was never the kind of substantial evidence where we would know it for sure. Nelson was really a psychopath. I mean, Nelson was where Dillinger. One writer about Dillinger said he was crooked but not twisted. You know, he stole to make money, but he was not a sick man the way Nelson seemed to like killing. Dillinger hooked up with him after he was arrested in Tucson, ended up back in Indiana, and then broke out of prison, broke out of the Crown Point jail in March of 1934. Well, Babyface Nelson was instrumental in helping him get out with money that Dillinger needed to buy off politicians, to procure the wooden gun that got him out of prison, and then Dillinger owed Nelson. And that's how they get together. He's part of the second John Dillinger gang. It was always a tense relationship, quite tense. Dillinger was Nelson was out of control, and Dillinger was really, as an outlaw, as a bank robber, was very much in control. He knew what he was doing.
Your book, by the way, Professor Gorin, we should say, covers 1 year, the year between 1933 and 1934. When they had all of these bank jobs and they stole thousands of dollars, and the FBI gets involved and all kinds of heavy law enforcement comes down on them. So let's go through this year a little bit as we talk here with Professor Elliot Gorin, who wrote the book Dillinger's Wild Ride, the year that made America's public enemy number one, because this is the year also where he's arrested. We see that famous photograph of him standing talking to reporters with, I believe it's the prosecuting attorney or maybe one of other law enforcement kind of has his arm around him, and they all look like it's old home week there.
It's an amazing photograph. It's truly an amazing
isn't
photograph.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
Now, where did that picture – yeah, tell me about that.
Well, let me just build up to it just a little bit.
Sure.
It all does take place in 1 year, and Dillinger gets out of the Indiana prison in the spring of 1933, and within a month or two, he's put together a gang – names that he's gotten from his friends in prison, and he's doing some stick-ups in Ohio and in Indiana. Always, you know, on the road, always, you know, trying to blur jurisdictions to be able to get away from those from the police who might pursue. Mm-hmm. He then manages to smuggle guns in to his friends in the Indiana State Prison, and by September of 33, 10 men have broken out, and a few of these form the core of the first Dillinger gang. Once these guys are together, they start really robbing banks until the end, almost the end of 1933. Then it becomes the police start to catch on and start to pursue them more with a little more heat. They're going back and forth from Chicago to other points in the Midwest. Finally, the Dillinger gang decides, we'll winter in, of all places, Daytona Beach. These are men who have been confined, you know, all of them for years. They, with their girlfriends, they all have girlfriends, they get in their cars and they drive 2,000 miles south to Florida, and they hang around enjoying it for several weeks, and then for some reason decide, no, let's go to Tucson, Arizona. Probably they had a notion of some kind of job there and the possibility of fleeing to Mexico. In Tucson, in January of 1934, they're captured. they're recognized. They're by local police and fire department from True Detective magazine. Their photographs are in there. They're arrested. Not a shot is fired. And then the Dillinger and his men, Charles Mackley, Harry Pierpont, and the others are extradited back to the Middle West. Dillinger for murder, the murder of a policeman in East Chicago, Illinois. That's when we get to this moment. Dillinger's back in the Crown Point jail in Crown Point, Indiana, about an hour from Chicago. That he, after this long, long trip where he, six plane rides and then a car over 24 hours to get from Tucson to Chicago, very primitive air transportation in those days, he walks into the jail, puts his arm on the shoulder of the prosecuting attorney, Robert Estall, the man who's going to send him to the electric chair if he can, puts his arm, and Estall, almost without thinking, puts his arm around Dillinger, and there is this photograph of these two arm-in-arm smiling for the camera, with the sheriff, a woman, Lillian Hawley, standing right beside them. Of course, the Attorney General of the United States goes ballistic when he sees this this photograph that's in all of the papers in America. There's newsreel footage. It's in all of the theaters. And it's, this image is really what makes Dillinger very, very famous. He was famous before that, but here is an image of a man so cool, and people see it.
Yeah, and he's talking to reporters. I don't remember. I don't know if there's an account. There's a little bit of it in the movie, but I don't know if it's accurate. What was he saying to those reporters? What was Dillinger bantering with those reporters and with the attorney about?
You know, it's just small talk. It's really just small talk. It's the sort of thing again that you know, under these circumstances, the man is being put in prison for his life, and he's just smiling and making small talk and chit chat. That's the thing about it. It's this kind of coolness that's so much.
Yeah, there's also that sort of world of lawmen and outlaws. The even though they're on opposite sides of the law, they seem to understand each other, and there seems to be a moment there where you know, mutual admiration kicks in. But of course, this was a time in America before celebrity was new. We had newsreels, we had visual images. It was before we recognized the cost to society. Dillinger had already killed police officers before this, hadn't he?
He's accused of killing one in East Chicago, and certainly the gang, before it's over, before it ends in July of 1934, at least a dozen people lose their lives because of the Dillinger gang. And that includes members of the gang, that includes police, innocent bystanders. They rob something like $350,000 from a dozen banks, and in today's currency, that's about $5 million. So this is a real
money,
injury. That takes place over this year. And again, all of it accompanied by headlines all over America.
And the techniques used by the police back then, I guess today officers would look at that, cops would look at that, citizens would look at that and say, I don't know how they got away with half of this stuff. Here's a guy talking, he hasn't got an attorney. Who knows what kind of interrogation techniques they used, how they chased these guys down. I'm sure John Dillinger, were he a man with immortality, would be alive and free today if he had the right lawyer. But we're going to talk about all of this and get back to our discussion here with Professor Gorn. Professor Elliot Gorn from Brown University has written the book, Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One. And we, of course, will, you know, end with that famous scene outside the Biograph Theater in Chicago where John Dillinger finally meets his end. We're back with Professor Elliot Gorn, author of Dillinger's Wild Ride, here in just a couple of minutes in the world-famous Phil Hendry Show on Crime Night.
Phil Hendry. This is the Phil Hendry Show.
World-famous Phil Hendry Show. We're back with Professor Elliot Gorn, author of Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One, here on Crime Night. And we were just talking, Elliot, about that famous series of photographs and the documentary film footage of John Dillinger there in the Crown Point Jail with his arm around the prosecuting attorney with the female sheriff of the county. And what was her name again?
Lillian Hawley. Her husband had been killed just a few months before. And it was not uncommon in the Midwest for women to take over for their husbands from law enforcement.
According to the film, Professor, and you can give us some clarity here, she was very forceful with the judge when asked whether the jail that she was presiding over could hold John Dillinger, and she said it absolutely can. Don't worry about it. Was she that kind of woman? She was a pretty strong-willed and adamant person?
Yeah, she was, and it was not only her. I mean, a lot of people had an interest in him staying there. It was their show. It was their moment in the sun. It was their. They really believed that the jail was breakout proof. And in a sense, it was. It wasn't a matter. It wasn't the jail was not weak in any sense. It's that the politics of Lake County, Indiana, had been for years very, very corrupt, and that's what really mattered. The possibility of bribery, of getting out that way.
Absolutely. And just one more thought on the film footage. It is, I think, the only real clear film footage we have of any of those prominent gangsters of the 30s. There's a shot of Dillinger behind bars where he looks rather amused and then disdainful at the camera. He's a handsome guy in a rugged outlaw way. I don't think there's a face like his. And, of course, he had that name, too, that almost sounds like I said at the beginning of the interview. It sounds like a weapon, doesn't it? Dillinger, Derringer.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, the family, up until when it becomes famous, people do start pronouncing it Dillinger. But the family actually pronounced it Dillinger, which in some ways haven't
Dillinger.
Even harder. It's a German name. It has an even harder sound to it. Dillinger.
Now, the shootout between the gang and law enforcement in Wisconsin, was that before or after this Crown Point event?
That's after he breaks out of Crown Point. That's a month afterwards.
Tell us about this, because it was a wild, it was a crazy, crazy, and the cops involved were making all kinds of mistakes.
It really was quite a scene. After a couple of very successful robberies that netted a lot of money, Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, Homer Van Meter, some of the women who were with their girlfriends, go to a place that was known as a possible hideout for some underworld figures, a lodge called Little Bohemia up near Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And it's still pretty cold out. It's April. It's cold up in northern Wisconsin. But they go there to just lie low for a few days. They're tipped. The family that owns Little Bohemia manages to get word out to the FBI. And Hoover and Melvin Purvis, the special agent in charge in Chicago, mobilize a dozen agents to get up to northern Wisconsin very quickly by plane, driving up, and they manage to assemble at nightfall. And the question is, what do you do? How do you take them? Well, actually, the movie does do a fairly good job of getting it right. Some patrons emerge from the lodge. They were there drinking, and they try to tell them to stop, and they're in their car, and they don't stop, and they start shooting. A few of the three innocent men are shot, one fatally. Now, while much of this shooting is going on, unbeknownst to the FBI, that shooting and then their shooting at the building, Dillinger and his accomplices manage to escape through the back of the Little Bohemia Lodge and just walk along the back of the shore there of Spider Lake, and then finally they steal cars. From people who were there, it's a huge shootout. Subsequent to the killing of those people, and the one of them is
the civilians.
Conservation Corps worker. After that, Babyface Nelson goes to steal a car and kills an FBI agent, wounds a peace officer. It's a terribly bloody. It's a horrible incident. Initially, the newspapers cover it as just the savagery of the Dillinger gang, and then it starts to turn after a couple of days. The FBI did make some terrible mistakes here, not the least of which was not cooperating with local law enforcement to block the roads. These guys could have easily been blocked in, the Dillinger gang, but there was no one there to block at key moments, at key points to block the roads.
And as I say, the police officers back then, I don't think they had the education they do now. That cop that was shot by Babyface Nelson was shot point blank, wasn't he? I mean, Nelson just basically put the gun in his face and killed him.
That's an important thing about the FBI. It wasn't even called the FBI back then. It was part of the Division of Investigation in the Justice Department. They had mostly taken care of white-collar crime up till then. It's only in the Dillinger era when they start routinely carrying weapons, training with weapons. They really were learning their job, learning what it meant to be a federal police force in this era, really confronting John Dillinger and his like. That was part of the trouble. It was not a very large force. And again,
the other thing too that I was going to just mention. The other thing too is that I believe Dillinger and some other the other gangs were carrying now what was a relatively new weapon, the Browning automatic rifle. It was an automatic weapon that they automatically had more firepower than the police, including the FBI at that time. Did the FBI carry anything heavier than that, than a pistol or perhaps some kind of a shotgun or a riot gun?
Well, the key is by now the FBI did have Thompson machine guns, and that's really the key weapon in all of this. Where in a chaotic situation, just huge amounts of ordnance can be just sprayed. And the first thing, this is long before Little Bohemia, there were some police departments had Thompson machine guns, which actually originate in World War One, and also bulletproof vests. That's really key. One of the first things members of the Dillinger gang do after they get out of the Indiana State Prison when Dillinger's on the loose is break into police armories and steal Thompson machine guns and bulletproof vests. Really key to this. When Dillinger allegedly does shoot that policeman in East Chicago, supposedly Officer O'Malley had shot at Dillinger, and of course the bullets bounced off the vest he was wearing, and Dillinger turns and returns fire and kills him. That's how that allegedly happened.
Professor Elliot Gorn with us tonight, folks. He's written the book Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One. If you're fascinated by the life and times of John Dillinger, maybe you saw Public Enemies and you want the real story and the historical document, read Professor Gorn's book, Dillinger's Wild Ride. Congratulations on a great book, Professor. Thanks for being with us tonight on Crime Night. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much. My pleasure.
877-876-PHIL. This is the world famous Phil Hendry Show.
Phil Hendry.